It's good to see everyone out this morning. If you had, he's going to complain about his contacts this morning. You're right. I don't know if I've got two contacts in the same eye or no contacts in one eye, or I don't know. So it's just, it's really a lot of fun. And then a couple of weeks ago, you may have read this, I went to the dumpsters there on New Life. There wasn't a car around. I'm talking to myself as I typically do, and I'm just slinging bags, and I hear, "Hey, what are you doing?" And a guy stands up, and part of my soul left my body. I was heading into the restroom just a few minutes ago, and as I reached for the door, it swung open, and Dane and I were just face to face, and I had that same moment. I wanted to scream, and I knew that was not appropriate, that Dane would probably not appreciate it, but man, I wanted to scream so loud and run so far. So I say that to say I'm not as scared to be up here this morning as I was to be back there a few minutes ago. And it's a relief to have some separation from everybody. But this eye thing may be interesting. I may need to go get the ladder. If I can get up higher from it, I can see a lot better. So that's a good thing. We're going to try to continue this study on chasing the wind, looking at life and becoming disillusioned with the illusions that sometimes we convince ourselves of. So those are the things that we need to become disillusioned about. I read a story of a man who took a solo trip to the Scottish Highlands just to do some exploring and some looking around. He did his research, and in Scotland, they have what they call freedom to roam laws. And those things essentially say that you can basically go wherever you want to and explore anything that you want to. And the writer said that he planned on taking advantage of that he decided that he was going to go down a certain road, that if he wanted to do that was exactly what he was going to do. There's a place in Scotland called the Isle of Skye. You can Google pictures. You can look at there. You can buy a plane ticket. It's a beautiful place. There's a rock formation on there called the Old Man of Storr. And again, you can Google that a little bit later. You don't have to do it just now. And so he drives across Scotland, and he got to the Isle of Skye so he could go up to the rock formation, and he begins climbing this hill, a very, very steep and muddy hill. And there's no one else around him, which he kind of thinks is weird because it's a fairly popular tourist spot, but there's no one there. And again, he starts climbing this steep hill, about ankle deep in mud. And the further up he got, the colder it got, the more misty it got, and the fog was there. But he kept climbing and climbing. There wasn't a trail. Again, no signs. There weren't any other tourists around, but he thought, I'm here to do what I came to do. I want to see the things that I want to see. I want to have the experience that I came here to experience. But the further and further up, he thought, where am I at and what am I doing? He knew he wasn't necessarily doing anything wrong. He wasn't in a place necessarily where he shouldn't be because of the freedom to roam laws. He could be wherever he wanted to be, but maybe what was he's doing there popped in his mind. Maybe what I'm doing isn't so wise. There's no towns, there's no cities, no villages. He was just out in the middle of nowhere. He even reasoned that the only person who knew where he was his wife, who was half a world away back in Texas. And he thought, if I fall and I get hurt, there's not going to be anybody out here that's going to be able to help me. And it just kept going over in his mind that though this was what he wanted to do, and he wanted to see this his way. And so finally he got to be about as high as that he could get and get the pictures that he wanted to get. He got back to his car, and he realized that maybe what he had been doing just hadn't been very wise. Not to mention that when he got back to his car and he drove around the next bend, there was a huge parking area with lots of tourists and trails leading up the other side of this hill, straight to the other side, to the Old Man of Storr. There were all kinds of people that could have helped him. But the question of, is this wise? Something might not necessarily be wrong, but it might not be wise either. That's something that I think maybe we need to spend more time thinking about. We say, well, it's not wrong, but what do we ask, is this wise? So, and there's so many different applications to that. I think one in our own discipleship, as we seek to follow Jesus and be who we are supposed to be, we have to go beyond, is this wrong? With whatever behavior, with whatever thoughts that we're having, we have to ask, does this go beyond being wrong, and is this wise? We do that sometimes with our discipleship. Again, we do that with our parenting. We have to help our kids ask the question, is this not just wrong, but is this wise as well, or is this not wise? What's sin and what's not sin? What's good and what's bad? But again, also, what's wise and what's foolish? Now, I'll give maybe three reasons this morning of why we need to go beyond asking just is it wrong, and also ask, is it wise? And the first is uncertainty, because sometimes we're uncertain about a behavior, whether a behavior is right or wrong, even though whether or not it's wise is pretty clear. If you were to stop that man, I think, halfway up the hill and asked him if what he was doing was wrong, I think he would have said, I don't think so. I think I'm perfectly within my rights. But had you asked him, is what you're doing wise, I think that answer would have been clear as well. So sometimes that's true when we are thinking about our discipleship. Sometimes that's with our own parenting, when we're trying to share the gospel sometimes with someone else. Sometimes some behaviors we're just uncertain about. Is it wrong, or is this right? We aren't so sure. But is this wise? What are you trying to accomplish here? Is this going to accomplish the goal that you want it to accomplish? Maybe the second reason that we need to ask ourselves, is it wise, is because the self-deception we have sometimes, because we can convince ourselves that something is right, even though we know it's not wise. I'm pretty good at that one. And the third one I'm pretty good at, too, is apathy. Sometimes I just don't care whether it's right or wrong. Sometimes I don't care if that's a sin or not, but we might care if that's wise. Again, maybe we're thinking about ourselves. Maybe we're thinking about our kids, and our kids say, I don't care if that's right or wrong, but do you care whether or not it's wise? Or maybe when we're sharing the gospel and we say, don't you know that behavior that you're doing, don't you know that that's wrong? And they say, I don't care that it's wrong. Or they say, I don't care that you think that it's wrong. But they might care that it's not wise, that's not going to accomplish what they want it to accomplish. It's not going to lead them where they want to go. So we need to kind of learn to think beyond and ask beyond, is it just wrong? And also ask, is it wise? It's good to ask, is this behavior wrong? Ask that question. But also ask, is it wise? Where is this headed? What is this going to accomplish? That's why I like the book of Ecclesiastes, because Ecclesiastes is more than just about morality, but it's also about the futility. It's not just about, is this behavior right or wrong? As Christians, sometimes that's sort of where the only framework that we want to work in is this is right or wrong? But Ecclesiastes goes beyond questions of morality and gets into questions of futility and vanity. Is this going to last? Is this going to really turn out how I want it to? That's why I think in our day and time, the book of Ecclesiastes is a terrific way to introduce someone to the gospel, because again, it goes beyond questions of morality and gets into questions of futility. Because even if someone cannot recognize that the path they're on is wrong, They might be able to recognize that the path they're on is not wise. Sometimes that's true with each and every one of us. We can't recognize that the path we are on is wrong, but we might be able to recognize the path we're on isn't wise. And Jesus introduces us to a better path to be on. I don't think that there could be a more relevant idea for this time in our age and our context than what the preacher of Ecclesiastes brings to us. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this was also vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? The word vanity is the word that we've been talking about. It's that Hebrew word hevel. It's meaningless. It's vapor. It's vanity. It's smoke. It's not only the temporary, but it's also to some extent an illusion. And that's what we're going to be talking about, is that pleasure and enjoyment that we are constantly pursuing, that it's not only temporary and it vanishes so quickly, just like an illusion, but we also have the tendency to chase it. And we chase it and we say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do what I want to do and I'm going to experience what I want to experience and feel what I want to feel and explore all the things that I want to explore. And if I just experience all of these things, only then can I obtain happiness. I'll be satisfied. I'll be filled. This is the life that I am pursuing. And so many other people seem to have it and to be experience it, and we scroll through maybe their social media feeds and we see their houses and we see their cars and their lives and we think it's right there. Well, why can't I have that? And the preacher of Ecclesiastes says, it's hevel, it's vapor, it's smoke, it's meaningless. He says, let's go down that path. Let's explore that together. Let's check this out. And let's see if it's wise. Verse 3 says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what good for the children of man to do under the heaven during the few days of their life. And you notice he says, my wisdom was still with me. This isn't just unbridled passion. This isn't just a kid being a kid and running amok and doing whatever that they want to do. This is somebody saying, I'm really honestly trying to discern and figure out whether or not this is a worthwhile pursuit, whether or not this is leading me to where I want to be led to go, whether or not this is life. Maybe this is what life is about. Maybe this is meaningful. Maybe this is what you should pursue. Maybe this is what people should do. Maybe this is how people should live. It's just indulge yourself. Just enjoy yourself. Just do whatever you feel like doing and go wherever you feel like going and exploring whatever you feel like exploring. Maybe that is what people should do. And he says, I'm really trying to examine this. But then notice the theme that he brings out throughout this book. Is during the few days of their life, this idea of mortality is something that is before him, because it's always before us, right? It's something that we're always aware of, that I only have a few days here. When I go on a trip somewhere, that's how I feel. I want to experience everything while I'm there, because I'm only going to be there for a few days and then I'm going to be gone. How should I spend my time? We are aware of that in our own lives. I'm only going to be here for a few days. This is going to end. So this is what I'm going to do while I'm here. We call that sometimes a bucket list. I want to accomplish all of these things before I go. How should people spend their life? Maybe they should spend their life having as much fun as they can, enjoying themselves, accumulating as much stuff, consuming as much pleasurable things as they possibly can. Will that lead to life? Will that cause you to have a meaningful life? That's the question before us, because it's the question that humanity has always had the tendency to ask. What is a worthwhile pursuit? Verse 4 says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools for which to water the forests of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any of who could have been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. You'll notice as you go through there, all of the verbs, all the things he said, I do this. What did he do? I made, I built, I bought, I gathered, I got, I did it all. I accumulated. Again, there's nothing more relevant than our context. There's no more wisdom needed in the 21st century in the Western world than this right here. The preacher says, I tried it. I made it. I bought it. I gathered it. I got all of this stuff. I enjoyed all of these things. I consumed. I accumulated. For whom? For whom did he do all of these things? Did he go and buy and make and gather and get? Himself. Says myself, 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 myself. Four times he says myself. That's what we have a tendency to do, is consume for ourselves, to enjoy for ourselves, to gather for ourselves, to buy for ourselves, to build for ourselves, to make for ourselves. He says, I did it all. I did all of these things for myself. I pursued all of my pleasures. And notice again that he says that I bought and I got people, servants and slaves and singers and concubines. Now, even though in our context it might be a little bit different, but when we pursue a life that is full of pleasure, people become pawns and puppets to us as well. We fool ourselves so that people exist in our story to bring us pleasure. Even though we don't technically legally enslave people, we tell ourselves a story that other people are in our lives to bring us pleasure. That's why you're here. That's why I invited you into my story, so you can make me happy. So you can please me. So something that we do sometimes with our own family. Sometimes we do that with professional athletes. Sometimes we do that with entertainers. We think you're here to entertain me. I don't want to hear your opinions. Shut up and sing, right? That's what we say. I don't want to hear your thoughts. I don't want you to be a real person in real life. You're just here to entertain me. You're just here to make me happy. Shut up and sing. When we pursue a life that is full of pleasure, people become pawns and puppets in our story. But the truth is nobody exists for your pleasure. Nobody exists to make you happy. They are real people the same as you are. But the preacher is exploring all of this because we do all of this. This is what human beings do. We accumulate, we consume, we chase after pleasure to the point of accumulating other people in our lives and say, do something to make me happy. Make me laugh. Sing for me. Please make me happy. The preacher is asking the question, where does this path lead? Where is this life of accumulation headed? The life of pleasure. The life of accumulating other things and other people to make you happy, will it lead to the life that you want to have? Verse 7 says, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was reward for all my toil. He says, I work hard. And what did he do? Again, he says, he made, he bought, I built, I gathered, I got. He says, I did all of this. I worked incredibly hard for a reward. And I got that reward. And his reward was all that his eyes could see. And his heart got all the pleasure that he wanted to have. And he became great. And so he had greatness and he had pleasure and enjoyment. This was his reward. And human beings have this tendency to justify all kinds of behavior by saying, this is my reward. I deserve this. I deserve to be happy. I've worked hard and I've sacrificed a lot and I deserve to be happy. There's a heartbreaking story just a few years ago that a well-known Christian apologist was having inappropriate relationships with a whole bunch of different women over several different years. And one of the things that he would tell himself about those relationships were those were his rewards for service to God. But we have a tendency to do that too on a lower scale sometimes. To say, I deserve whatever it is. I deserve to be happy, or even God wants me to be happy. God wants me to enjoy this. This is my reward for all the hard work I've done, for all the sacrifices I've made, for all of my toils, for all my labors. I deserve to be happy. And we have a tendency to pursue all kinds of behaviors, some of which are questionable, some of which are just wrong, but all of which are unwise. But we justify them and we say, I deserve to be happy, or God would want me to be happy. I've worked hard. And so he says in the last there at verse 11, in conclusion, I considered all that my hands had done and that the toil had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. He says, I got my reward. My reward was pleasure. My reward was enjoyment. My reward was greatness. And then I looked at my reward and I looked at all that I've chased and all that I've gathered and all of these things that I have. And what was it? It was hevel. It was smoke. It was just vapor. It was meaningless. It was futile. All of it disappeared. It was just an illusion. We work so hard and we accumulate so much. We do all of these things and we say, if I do this and if I can have this, we can accumulate and consume, but it's all just smoke and it never really satisfies us. As we said a few weeks ago, there's not one of us in here that has ever ate a meal and said, I'm never going to have to eat again. That was the best meal ever. Because what? And 45 minutes later, we're probably looking for an ice cream cone. We're always hungry again. No matter how pleasurable or enjoyable or satisfying it is, it only lasts a moment. And we also feel like, and we realize that so many of the other things that we chase are just so full of hype. They never live up to their promise. They're always somewhat of a disappointment. They're always temporary and they're always gone much too soon. And the preacher says, I've had it all. I've worked hard and I've had everything that comes from working hard. All of this toil, all of this chasing, this pursuing, this seeking, I got all the rewards. Anything you can imagine and you can think of, it would make you happy. He says, I've had it and it's hevel. It's smoke. It's meaningless. It's vanity. And this is why Ecclesiastes is a perfect introduction to the gospel. Because Ecclesiastes shows us, helps us to become disillusioned with the worldly things, while Jesus helps us get enamored with heavenly things. This is necessary. If we are going to appreciate the gospel, this is key. To become disillusioned with worldly things so that Jesus can help you become enamored with heavenly things. So that we become disillusioned with pleasure. We become disillusioned with indulgence. We become disillusioned with accumulation and consumption. When we realize that all of these pursuits are hevel, all of them are vanity. I encourage you this morning to read all of 1 Timothy chapter 6. But just to finish up this morning, let's focus on verses 6 through 8 here. It says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we can be content. Paul's not just promoting contentment. It's good to be content, but contentment is not just what Paul is teaching. It's godliness with contentment. That's great gain. That's the life that is truly meaningful. Look at verse 9. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through the craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Notice that, pierced themselves with many pangs. They plunged themselves into ruin and destruction. Pursuing pleasure is not even in your own best interest. I know it seems that way, right? But that's the illusion of it all. It seems like if I just had all this stuff, if I just had that bigger house or nicer car or nicer clothes, if I just had whatever it is, whatever that lifestyle it is that it seems that other people have obtained, then I would be happy. Then I could truly leave a legacy. None of that brings happiness and contentment that we are pursuing. But then we also plunge ourselves into ruin and destruction through this craving. Through this desire, this love of money, it's the craving, it's the desire, the love of the passion that plunges us into ruin and destruction. You don't even have to be rich to plunge yourself into ruin and destruction. You just have to want to be rich, desire it, chase it. But then he contrasts that with verse 11. But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, gentleness. This is the way in which we take hold that is truly life. Paul wants Timothy and Timothy's audience to understand that this life of pursuing pleasure and accumulation and consumption is not life. Not only is it not life, it's hevel. It's vapor, it's smoke, but you're also going to plunge yourself into ruin and destruction by going down this path. The path that leads to life is the path of the cross. The way of the cross is the way of the wise. The way of the cross recognizes the brevity of life. The way of the cross recognizes the inevitability of death. The hevel of worldly pursuits. The way of the cross is generous and selfless and sacrificial, and it's filled with hope. The way of the cross is the way in which we live forever. If you want to live forever, if you want to take hold of that which is really life, then take up your cross and follow Jesus. The way of the cross is the way of the wise, because all of the other pursuits, they plunge us in to ruin and destruction. Even our secular friends are recognizing how these pursuits are not really meaningful, that it's futile. And then they begin searching for something else. What can I latch onto? What can I believe in? And then we can share the good news of Jesus Christ. The way of the cross is the way of the wise. That when we are baptized into Jesus, it's not just the life that we are giving up. And we say, I'm going to no longer pursue a life of vanity and futility, but I'm also going now to pursue the way of the cross. And we are raised up to walk out of that water in a new life, to share that good news with other people. So if there's someone here this morning and you need to be baptized, you're ready to pursue the way of the cross, or you need to be encouraged anyway, please come as together we stand and we sing.